Now I begin to think I can put the pieces back together. Not in exactly the same way, of course. But maybe, just maybe, even better. Is it Lark that makes me feel that everything isn't as grim as it first seemed? Now that I've met a friend, shared my secret, anything seems possible. Not that I don't have enough problems of my own to worry about, but somehow I keep thinking back to everything Lark told me about all the supplies, the one-child policy, her vague theories about something being wrong with Eden. But what does that matter? The world is what it is, dead outside, alive in here. And I have to make the best life for myself given what I have. Whatever is going on in the government and supplies, or in the electronic heart of the Ecopanopticon, that's not my problem. My heart slows to the point that I can have a real look around me. We're walking briskly through the next entertainment ring. While the one nearest my house, the entertainment district closest to the center, seemed loud and boisterous at the time, I can now see that by comparison with this ring, it was quiet, civilized, and staid. There people walked slowly, in orderly fashion, politely making way for one another. Here they jostle and shove. There seem to be many more people. More security, too. Did Lark make a mistake going this way? They have other things to worry about, she says when I express my concern. Look over there. I see a man standing on a small folding stool, head and shoulders above the crowd. Fragments of his impassioned speech reach me. Dominion over land and sea, over the beasts of the earth and the fish of the sea. Few people seem to be paying him any attention. Most just walk by. But every once in a while, someone stops to shout a curse. And once someone hurls soggy scraps of a sandwich at him. He keeps on declaiming with the burning eyes of a fanatic. Idiot, Lark says, scowling in his direction. That's the kind of thinking that got us here in the first place. What is the Dominion exactly? I ask. I've heard the term occasionally, but I only have the vaguest idea what it's all about. It's a cult, or a political movement, depending on who you talk to, Lark said. They believe that humans were meant to rule the Earth, and that destroying it was just part of the master plan. Whose master plan? I ask. She shrugs. They talk about a book written thousands of years ago that gives them permission to kill and destroy and conquer whatever they like. As far as I know, no one has ever seen or read this book, though. Now they mostly just spout off about how, when the Earth is finally healed, then people can reclaim their rightful place on the top of the food chain, slaughtering animals and laying waste to the land. I shudder. How could anyone actually think like that? I remember reading in eco-history how in our distant past, huge animals like cows and sheep were raised only to be killed and eaten. If a cow walked through Eden right now, every citizen would fall on their knees in amazement. Except for the Dominion members. They'd probably start slicing steaks. But the Dominion do have one thing right, Lark said. What's that? I ask nervously. I know that mere association with the Dominion carries a mandatory prison sentence. Humans belong out in the world, not trapped in a prison city. But Eden is the only reason we survive, I say. How could we live out there? I gesture in the direction of the far edge of the city. Lark shrugs. I didn't say it was possible, she says. Only that's where we belong. We're part of nature, not this artificial paradise. I look back at the proselytizer. Why don't they arrest him? Oh, they will, once anyone starts listening to him. Agreeing with him. He's safe until he has an audience. As long as he has no support, he's just an advertisement for the movement's foolishness. He'll be in prison soon enough. I shudder again. That's my fate, at the very least, if I get caught. Lark notices. Don't worry, she says. As long as you're with me, you're safe. I know these streets like the back of my hand. That phrase makes me think of Mom, and calms me. Lark seems so fearless, so confident, that it's rubbing off on me. I feel safe with her at my side. It's a long, circuitous walk back to my house. We even pass her house, though she doesn't point it out till we've walked beyond it. I crane my neck to see the soft, warm glow in one of the windows. Lark is chatty, which is a novelty to me. Ash tells me all about his day as soon as he gets home. And no matter how tired Mom is after work, she always makes a point of sitting down with me for a while before I go to sleep. But so many of my hours have been spent in silence. Just hearing Lark's patter is so interesting that I sometimes lose the train of her conversation and just listen to the flow of her voice, marveling that it is directed at me. Soon all of my life will be like this, with friends and conversation, but Lark will always be the first. I'm lucky, too, that she takes the burden of the conversation on herself. Most of the time, I don't really know what to say, how to respond. But she seems to understand, and barrels through any of my awkward pauses with a steady flow of words. She makes all this new socializing almost easy for me. When we reach our home circle, Lark suddenly stops, gripping my hand tightly. "What is it?" I ask in alarm. She seems frozen. A few seconds later, though, she relaxes, though she doesn't let go of my hand. I thought, never mind. "No, tell me," I say. She sighs, then smiles. "After what you've shared with me, I guess I don't have the right to hide anything from you. I have seizures." She explains how a quirk in her brain makes her have seizures. "It's kind of like a lightning storm in my brain. The neurons go crazy. The episodes usually aren't too bad, and I can almost always feel them coming on. The world goes kinda different. Floaty. I get a little dizzy. That's why I thought I was going to have a seizure just now. The ground seemed to shift, and I felt off balance. Did you feel it?" I shake my head. I think my heart is pounding too fast, too loud in my chest for me to notice any other sensation. She smiles at me, and we walk on, still hand in hand. When we finally reach my house, I almost don't recognize it. I've always seen it from the inside. My only glimpse from the outside was when I was fleeing it, and I didn't look back. It seems strangely stayed after the opulence of the rest of the city. The gray stones look natural. The rest of the city is all artifice. Beautiful, bright, but not natural. The sight of home, with its interlocked pattern of real stones, its muted, mossy gray color, makes me homesick in anticipation. This is where I belong, I think. I can't leave home. I can't. Lark lays a hand on my shoulder, distracting me. "You are so lucky to live here," she says. "I know I am, but I ask, why?" expecting a conventional answer. She surprises me. "I can't imagine what a thrill it must be to live in the home of Aaron Albaz. Always wondered why there isn't a plaque on the wall commemorating it." I look at her blankly. "The creator of Ecopan lived here? You didn't know?" I shake my head. "My dad told me. He was the only one in Eden allowed to have a real stone house. Everything else is synthetic, but he insisted on keeping a connection to the earth. Stones aren't alive, people said, but he told them that stones are the earth's bones." I process for a moment, then say, "So I'm living inside a skeleton." She tilts her head and laughs. "An ossuary. A bone house." "Why don't I know this?" I ask. She shrugs. "We all have our secrets," she says, and winks at me. "Are you going to be in trouble when you go in?" I honestly have no idea what awaits me. "Thanks for getting me back safely," I tell her, thinking I should make some formal gesture. A bow, a handshake. "I really like you. I mean, meeting you," I stammer. "Can you sneak out tomorrow?" she blurts out. "Of course," I say without thinking. "Will it be possible? After tonight's escapade, I doubt I can elude my parents again. Would I be brave enough?" I look into Lark's earnest eyes. "Yes, I think I will be." "Good," Lark says. "I'll meet you here tomorrow, just after dark." "Don't worry, I won't tell Ash what you've been up to." I asked her not to earlier. I'm still undecided about whether I want to tell Ash about sneaking out and meeting Lark. On balance, I don't think I will. At least not yet. I want this to stay mine. I don't want to share. She tilts her head up to peer at the wall around my courtyard. Her wisps of lilac hair fall away from her face. "Can you really climb that?" she asks, amazed. Remembering how I had to fall the last few feet, I have my doubts. Nervously, I find a tiny handhold and grip, tensing my muscles to pull myself up. "Hold on, silly," says Lark as she catches my shoulder and gently wheels me around. "Aren't you even going to say goodbye?" "Just say the word," I tell myself. But I can't. She's looking at me with a quirky smile, curled up at one side, down at the other. Goodbye feels tragic. "Until tomorrow," I say instead, and she laughs and hugs me. "Until tomorrow," she repeats, as if it's a magic spell. Suddenly, I want to impress Lark. She has been the strong one, guiding me through the city, soothing my worries. Now I want to look strong and capable. While she's watching, I leap onto the wall, and with nothing but instinct find the perfect holds. Though they're hardly more than hairline cracks, my fingertips and toes seem glued to the wall. Smoothly, hiding the effort under a veneer of pure grace, I ascend halfway up, then hang my head back to look down at her. It's a reckless move, almost pitching me off balance. But isn't that what this night is about? Throwing caution to the wind? I'm gratified to see her look at me with open-mouthed amazement. Her lilac hair is almost glowing, a bright spot against the gray of my house. "Rowan, you're quite a surprise," she says, almost too softly for me to hear. Elated, I scale the rest of the wall without a single mishap. At the top, I pause and look at her for a long moment. Then I swing my legs over the wall to continue the last few days of my prison sentence. I'm prepared for anything. Mom weeping. Dad shouting. Everyone gone, searching for me. But to my surprise, the house is quiet and dark. I creep inside, slip off my shoes, and pass silently to Mom and Dad's bedroom. Door is slightly ajar. Peeking in, I can see their shapes as they sleep. Dad on his back on one side of the bed. Mom curled away from him at the far corner. Did they really not know I left? Or did they just give up? Mom, always sensitive, surely decided I needed time alone and left me in the courtyard, apparently mulling over my fate. I close their bedroom door and head to my tiny bedroom. I pass by Ash's bedroom and pause by the door. He's sleeping too, his breath steady but slightly raspy. For a long moment, I look at his face. My face, almost. The resentment surges again. Why does he get everything? Well, I, a healthier version of him, rightfully first, get nothing. Then his breath catches and stops for a long moment. This happens a lot when he sleeps. I can't tell you how many times I've waited, my own breath held, for his breathing to start up again. So far, it always has. Someday, I fear, it won't. I count. 7, 8, 9. Finally, he sucks in a ragged breath and begins to snore gently. On one hand, the sound is annoying, but on the other, it is reassuring. The snores are a constant, gentle reminder that he's still breathing, still alive. I creep closer and look at his face, calm and restful in sleep. He looks young, much younger than I myself feel tonight. But then I remember Riley. I'm technically older than him. How could I have harbored a jealous thought about him? Suddenly I understand why Mom had to strip me of my first child privilege and let the world believe Ash is the one and only. She must have known even then that I could endure whatever suffering came my way. Ash, sick, sensitive, never could have. I look back at the endless weeks, months, years of solitude hidden away in this house. Somehow, I managed to find a measure of happiness for myself all that time. Or if not happiness, contentment. Sure, sometimes I cried, other times I raged, but I got through it. And as ripped apart as I might be about having to leave home now, a part of me knows that I can deal with it. It will be hard, but I can do it. A sense of peace washes over me. My anger is gone. Did meeting Lark do that? Or did it just come from inside? The same acceptance that helped me get through all these years. I'm so tired. so tired and so happy. Mom's right. Every child leaves home. I'm just doing it a little earlier than most, and under stranger conditions. But whoever's identity I assume, I'll still get to see my family, I'm sure of that. Mom wouldn't allow it to be any other way. And now I have Lark. Wherever I am in Eden, I'll have Lark. I'm almost to my room when I hear Ash stir behind me. Rowan? He asks. I know he's only half awake, that I could make it to my room and be alone with my thoughts of freedom and Lark and friendship, if only I keep going. But I turn and sit at his bedside. His eyes open a bit when he feels the compression of the bed. Where were you? He asks sleepily. In the courtyard, I reply. No, you weren't. I was. You just didn't see me. Or maybe I was inside when you were looking for me. He smiles, then the grin breaks in a yawn. It's a big house, but it's not that big. Where did you go? I checked all your hiding spots. I don't say anything. You went out, didn't you? It's a statement, not a question. My chin juts out defiantly. Maybe. He covers his eyes with his hand, rubbing them hard. What were you thinking, Rowan? You could have gotten caught or killed. I feel an urge to say I'm sorry. But I'm not. Not at all. I was just fine, I say instead. I catch myself. I almost said we. But I've decided not to tell Ash about Lark. Not yet. Sometimes a thing is too precious to bring out into the light. Somehow, talking about it might make the magic of the night evaporate. I didn't have any problems. No one looked at me twice. He's still angry. Or scared. How could you do something so stupid? He asks. Never mind what would happen to our family if you got caught. I flush and hang my head. I've hardly thought about that possible consequence of my adventure. You know what the authorities would do to you if they found out you existed. I don't, not really. I've never been told exactly. But the consequences hinted at ranged from torture, to prison, to slavery, to death. But oh, great Earth, it was worth it just to escape for one night. I try to explain this to Ash, telling him about the joy and fear of seeing the people, the lights, hearing the blare of music and the babble of hundreds of people at once. He nods, understanding the depth of my loneliness, my need for more. In a conciliatory voice, he says, Mom said you're going to get your lenses soon. The way he says this makes me think Mom hasn't told him I have only a few days left with my family. I'm so happy for you. He puts a hand over mine. Are you scared? Before I can answer, he adds, Of course you're not. You're not scared of anything. I give a small, rueful laugh. There's not much to be afraid of when you never leave the house. No, that's not true, he says. There's a new depth to him, and he seems to be looking inside himself as he talks to me. Just being alive can make people afraid. To have something so precious as life, that can be taken away at any moment. He swallows hard and licks his dry lips. Not you, though. I've never seen you afraid. I make a small confession. I was afraid when I was outside the house tonight. For a while, anyway. Ash shakes his head slowly. Nah, I don't believe you. Nerves, maybe. Anxiety. Uncertainty. But never fear. I know you, Rowan. You're completely brave. Even if all you ever had to face is boredom and loneliness, you've always faced them bravely. I know exactly how you'll be when you get out into that world at last. You'll eclipse me entirely. He sighs. Every time I fail, I think of you. And what you would do in my place. When I turn away from a group of people laughing and think they're laughing at me. When I try to tell Lark how I feel. I remember when Lark thought I was Ash. With some subtle difference. When her lips came near to mine. I flush in the darkness and say nothing. I'm basically a coward, Rowan, my brother confesses. Then he adds something that brings tears to my eyes. You should have been the firstborn. You would have been a benefit to Eden. More than me, anyway. What can I say? Reassure him that he is a wonderful person, an asset to the community, that he has no failings, only quirks, that he is loved. That I, in particular, love him, my other self. I wonder what I'll do without him. I wonder what he'll do without me. Go back to sleep, Ash. We can talk more in the morning. There is a melancholy edge to my thoughts, like the grim desert wasteland around Eden. But like the city itself, the center of my thoughts is bright as I drift off to sleep. I sleep late in my tiny bare chamber. When I wake, Ash is at school and Mom is at work. I feel a twinge of resentment. Shouldn't they be home with me for my last few days in the family? Who knows when I'll be able to see them again? I might even live in an entirely different circle and just be able to see them once a month for pho chai and chapatis in public. I hear a noise in the kitchen. My dad is home. I feel my jaw tighten right away, but make myself go in to say good morning. He's making an algae smoothie. Straight algae and water. No synth flavors. Ew. He doesn't hear me while the blender's whirring, but after he pours his green concoction into a tall frosted glass, he turns and flinches slightly upon seeing me. As if I shouldn't be there. A dribble of viscous green slush runs over the edge of his glass, pooling in the webbing between his thumb and forefinger. "You're up," he says. I don't know enough about people to determine if this stating of the obvious is a common conversational opener, but my dad does it all the time. I grab a sweet roll from the basket and take a big bite. "Congratulations on your appointment as vice chancellor," I say. "It isn't official yet." "Don't worry," I say wryly, unable to resist the jibe. "I won't tell anyone." Who could I tell for the next few days anyway? Except Lark. I decide to tell her tonight. An act of defiance. "I need to have you squared away before anything is publicly announced." He wipes the green drips with a pristine white cloth, then tosses the cloth into the reclamation chute. "Squared away? Is that all I am to you? An issue to be dealt with? A mess to be made neat?" Does my father hate me? I wonder. It's a question I've been shaping in my mind ever since I was old enough to pay attention to the world around me. "It's not as simple as that, Rowan," he says. "You create difficulties by your very existence." I feel my lip twitch. I want to delve into it more, but only say bitterly, "You'll be rid of me in a little while. That will be a relief, I guess." He takes another sip of his drink, scowling a bit as if he just realized how disgusting it is. "In a way," he says evasively. I look at him evenly. My feelings are mixed, but as before, anger trumps sadness. It's starting to be a trend with me, I think. "And you and Mom can move on with the perfect life I interrupted 16 years ago. Pretty soon it'll be like I never even existed at all." He doesn't answer. Only downs the remainder of his drink and heads out the door. Eight. It is a day like any other. Almost. Like every day for the past 16 years of my life, I spend a good portion of the daylight home alone. I have my routines to keep me sane. Studying, drawing, running, and exercising until my body is exhausted and my mind is calm. But today, there is a lilac tinge on everything I do. When I draw, I find myself sketching Lark's face. When I run, it's her I'm running to. When I pull up my data blocks and vids to study, I turn immediately to all of the things Lark and I talked about. I search for information on the Dominion, but there is precious little. That makes sense, I think, with a new touch of cynicism painted onto my personality by Lark. The people in charge don't want people to know about that evil cult, even disparaging things. Any information might lure new converts. So I search for other topics, expanding my knowledge so I'll have more to talk about with Lark. The thing that interests me most is the earliest days of Eden. I want to find out more concerning what Lark said about the original population of Eden. How were the first residents chosen? Were they just the last straggling survivors of humanity? Or were they specially selected? I need a clue about why our population started out so large, only to be trimmed down now. As one of the trimmed, I take it personally. But there's almost nothing beyond what I already know. In fact, every source says almost exactly the same thing, in almost identical words, like a mantra or a prayer. The remnants of the human species gathered in Eden to wait until the earth was renewed. That's all, as if people were some migrating animals who coalesced by instinct, going into hibernation to wait out a long winter. I've never noticed before how few details there are in our own history. I didn't question very much until now. I just swallowed down whatever I was fed. I turn instead to our founding father, Aaron Albaz. There's a ton of information on him, all of it laudatory. It reads more like a legend than pure history. Like every child in Eden, I learned all of this before, but now that I know I'm living in the great man's house, seems closer, more vital. I read how Albaz was mocked as a young man for his radical beliefs in the coming end of the world. Still, he attracted many followers, even as others condemned him and found fault in his science. He suffered deep humiliation as he was ostracized from the scientific community, his theories about man's doomed interaction with the Earth torn to shreds. Breathless, I read about his self-imposed exile as he heroically dedicated his life to saving the planet. He was so secretive during that time that there are very few facts, only anecdotes. He was trying to stop world governments from approving policies that were killing the environment. And from what I can gather, his methods were not 100% above the law. When the heads of nations wouldn't listen, he forced them to listen. In that newly burgeoning digital age when everything on the planet was already well on its way to being linked, a skilled computer scientist could force governments to pay attention. They called his methods hacking, techno-terrorism, cyber-guerrilla warfare. But he never harmed a soul. Not a person, or beast, or plant. Unlike the world governments and the destructive weapons and technology they controlled. Albaz only took over systems to prove his point. To make people see that they were on a path to destruction. And offer them an alternative. For his pains, he was questioned multiple times and placed under house arrest, his assets frozen. Somehow, he escaped prison for many years. Then came the Ecofail. According to the history I'm reading, the world governments were about to launch their mission to alter the atmosphere to fight global warming. A laudable ambition, though Albaz told them it wouldn't work. He tried to stop them, attacking the system that would launch the particles into the atmosphere. But he failed, and was thrown in prison. And while he was captive, the Earth died. By the time his followers broke him out, there was barely time to implement his long-term plan. The work of his lifetime. Eden. He activated the program that turned all of the world's technology toward two linked goals. Reviving the planet, and saving mankind. In an act of great nobility, he saved the people who betrayed him, and the Earth. Or as many as he could. He preserved the humans who had been unable to care for their own planet. Albaz gave us all a second chance. An opportunity to do penance for our selfishness, our stupidity. And I've lived in his house all my life, and never knew it. As soon as Mom comes home, before either Ash or Dad, I pounce with questions. How did we end up living in Aaron Albaz's house? Can we talk about it later? She asks. There are dark circles under her eyes, and her hair is uncharacteristically messy, with strands flying crazily out of her usually tight twist. We have a lot of other things to discuss. No, this is important, I say. How could I not know? She shrugs. It isn't a big deal. We're distant relations, through his sister, I think. But it was a long time ago. How did you find out? I didn't quite think that one through, but she doesn't seem to notice the long pause before I say. I came across a mention in an old history of Eden. Is there anything here that belonged to him? Oh, no. She says quickly. It was so long ago. Not really. 200 years isn't that many generations. She won't tell me anymore, and immediately changes the subject. Your lenses are ready to be implanted. I hurl myself into her arms. She's a little taken aback, and I realize that she's expecting me to still be upset at leaving home. I am, of course, but to my chagrin, the first thing I think of is that I'll be more easily able to walk the streets safely when I sneak out tonight to see Lark, with my eyes looking flat like everyone else's, and what's more, a key to someone else's identity. I can walk past any green shirt without a qualm. When do we leave? I ask. Oh, they're ready, but your surgery won't be for a little while. Another couple of days, at least. And with them I can pass as an official citizen? A firstborn? She nods. These will be a huge step up from the black market lenses criminals use. They can't access all of the technology. Some things, like the filter for the altered sun rays, and the identity chip, work okay on the cheap removable lenses. But there are deeper layers that no one has been able to suss out, until we found someone brilliant. Normally, the lenses are manufactured in a factory, and then sent to the center for further modification by EcoPan. The cyber surgeon we found managed to hack into the center to get the exact specifications. You don't have to worry. They'll work perfectly. Lots of other second children aren't as lucky as you. Lots? I repeat. This is the first time I've ever heard of other second children. What a day for revelations. A few, yes, but others use the cheap, removable lenses too. My sources don't talk much, as you can imagine. But from what I gather, there are criminals using lower quality fake lenses. Rebels. Cheating husbands and wives. So I'm in great company. But back to the second children. How many of us are there? I ask. She presses her lips together briefly. Not many. According to my source, perhaps 20 still walking the streets. Oh, that's... Wait, what do you mean still? Oh, honey, you'll be just fine. We found a real genius to make your lens implants. Bought the most secure identity. Bribed all the right people. What are you saying? She bites her lip. My source told me that the survival rate for second children trying to integrate into society isn't as high as we'd like. You mean, we die? No, no, she hastily begins, then amends it to, well, a few are captured, but there are a lot who simply disappear. A chill tickles my spine. Don't worry, honey, it won't happen to you. We've taken every precaution. She shakes her head as if tossing away the unpleasant thoughts. I'm haunted by the image of second children disappearing. The way my mom said it, it sounded like they just evaporate, turn to mist and drift away. It must be the center, though, capturing second children. They must be dragged away into the night and fog, and no one ever knows what happened to them. Mom won't talk about it anymore, no matter how much I press. Not long afterward, Ash comes home, and with a quick mutual glance, Mom and I agree not to discuss anything serious or worrying in front of him. Stress aggravates his condition. I also want to ask where I'll be going. Will it be to a childless couple? Will I be posing as an orphan, adopted by a kind relative? I might even have a brother or sister. Will I like them? My new family must be kind, though, if they're taking the risk of welcoming in a secret second child. They'll be generous, and loving, and patient, and caring. And they'll help ease my way into the world. I know they will, because only that sort of person would defy all Eden to help a child. How can I worry too much when I have Lark's company to look forward to? Dinner passes insufferably slowly. I know I should be savoring every moment with my family before it all changes, but my thoughts keep straying to tonight. Before I go to bed, I look at my strange, multicolored eyes. What will it feel like when my eyes are flat and dull like everyone else's? I won't be me anymore. Even though everyone I've really seen in my life, all four of them, aside from passers-by last night, has these flat, lifeless eyes, it shocks me to imagine seeing them staring blankly out of my face. Those flat eyes are unnatural. Wrong. In a way I never appreciated before. Until it became personal. All the light and variation of my irises will be crushed. They'll be a dull, gray-blue. I'll look like a blind girl, though my vision will be unchanged. Mom ducks her head into the bathroom, and I blink to hide the moisture gathering in my eyes. Your dad and I are taking the day off work tomorrow to be with you, and Ash is staying home. We'll have a real family party then. All your favorite foods. And we'll have a chance to talk about, she breaks off, some important things you need to know. Whatever they are, why did she wait until my final day is to tell me? Soon afterward, everyone is in bed. I pretend to sleep, too, but under my bed is a bag containing the clothes I plan to wear. I breathe slowly, quietly, listening to the sounds of the house. Ash turning in his sleep, the soft, settling sound the walls make when the temperature drops at night. When I'm sure everyone is deeply asleep, I grab my bag and slip out to the courtyard. Right on the other side is the world. And Lark. My fingers tremble as I strip off my nightclothes and stand almost naked in the dark. Above me, the stars twinkle dimly, and I tilt my head back to let their muted light fall on me. I know almost nothing about stars, not their names or the science behind them. But I love looking at their glowing patterns, because they remind me that there's a world outside of my courtyard, outside of Eden even. And they make me think of my most treasured possession, the ancient, faded, crumbling photo from before the Ecofail that Mom smuggled out of the archives. I've brought it to share with Lark. She can keep secrets. I thought more about what to wear than I did about leaving home. The fact embarrasses me, but I know that if I didn't have the distraction of Lark and sneaking out, I'd be going crazy with what's happening in the rest of my life. After long consideration, and much pawing through my meager wardrobe, mostly made up of duplicates of Ash's school uniforms and casual clothes, I settled on one of my few feminine pieces, a deep red skirt that flares to my mid-thigh. The material is imbued with subtle sparkles that flash when the light hits them just so. For the rest, I chose black, partly from limited choice, partly from an instinct that tells me that I may need to blend into the night if anything goes wrong. I tuck my black leggings into my soft ankle boots and adjust the shoulders of a snug synth wool sweater knitted in an open weave. I know I'll look dull alongside the lurid magenta and ultramarine and canary colors favored by the residents of Eden. But the shock of red at my hips is a rare treat for me. I hope Lark likes it. I don't want to trigger the alarm on the front door, so I scale the wall. Now I remember why I rarely wear skirts. And sit at the top, hunkered low to reduce my profile, looking for Lark. For one terrible moment, I don't see her. Then she emerges from the shadows, starlight on lilac, and the entire world seems to settle into place. I remember most of the tricky holds for the way down, and scale the wall easily, leaping down the last 4 feet just to show off. You're amazing, Lark cries as she runs up to me. How do you do that? When you climb, you look like a squirrel, or a gecko. And you look like a flower, I blurt out before I can stop myself. She lowers her head for a second, but when she raises it, her eyes are shining. Here, she says, and hands me a pair of glasses. I unfold them and see that the lenses are in a faceted kaleidoscope of pink and sky blue and lilac. Lark slips on a pair of her own. Dragonfly glasses, she tells me. Aren't they beautiful? Lots of people are wearing them, even at night, so no one will even think about your eyes. I put them on. Despite the facets on the lenses, when I look through them, my vision isn't fractured. The only difference is that a pink-purple glow is cast over the world. Eden has gone rosy tonight. Lark takes my hand. Come on. I want to run. And then we're off, down the road, our linked arms swinging, laughing, careless of who might hear us. We're just two girls enjoying life. Why would anyone look twice? It isn't long before she's panting, though. I'm only just warming up. I feel like I could run forever. I can't run like you, she gasps out. How did you get so fast and strong? There's not much else for me to do, except run and climb and stretch and exercise, I explain. She regards me in what I think is admiration. You're so... She breaks off, shaking her head. Do you know what you could do with speed like that? No one could ever catch you. The green shirts are soft compared to you. Why, I bet you could even outrun a security bot. And climbing could be pretty useful to someone who... She stops herself again. But we shouldn't talk about that now. Not until we get there. Where's there? I ask. She gives me her quirky up-and-down smile. That's for me to know. And you to find out. She crooks her elbow in mine, and we head to the nearest Autoloop station. Nine. Panic hits me as soon as we slide through the turnstile. Walking through a crowd on a public street where everyone goes about their own business is one thing. But here there's an actual checkpoint of sorts, where passengers have to pay for their ticket. I try to back up, but my thighs hit the turnstile's padded bar. One way, Lark says, catching my arm. More loudly, she adds for the benefit of those behind us annoyed at the holdup. Don't worry, the bathroom is over this way. What if they... I begin, but she shushes me with a squeeze. You'll be fine. I'll put the fare on my chip. Just act normal. Bick, money. I hadn't even thought about that. There's so many little things that could catch me out. I don't have any funds, of course, nor do I know how to use them, or what anything costs. Lark goes first to show me how it's done. It's simple. There's what looks like a mirror at the entrance to the Autoloop platform. She lifts her glasses and smiles into it, adjusting her flower-colored hair coquettishly, and says brightly, "Two, please." The mirror quickly dims and brightens again as it reads her eye implants. Her currency has been transferred, and two small chits roll out from a slot under the mirror. She heads through the corridor leading to the station platform. There are people in uniform everywhere. Only one is a green shirt, lounging against the wall at the far end of the station, chewing at a hangnail. But even the station attendants alarm me in their crisp, official-looking costumes. They have the bullseye insignia of the center on their lapels. And even if they're low-level functionaries, they still represent the establishment that is my natural enemy, whose lair I'm attempting to infiltrate. Ash was wrong about me. I am afraid. But I hold myself steady, and even force a playful, sidelong smile for the ticket taker. A smile that pretends to openness, but actually hides my eyes just in case he can glimpse anything from the side of the glasses. He takes my ticket and lets me pass. I feel elated with that simple success. I was afraid, but I did it anyway. Maybe, I think, that's what it means to be brave. Maybe Ash was right about me after all. Holding my head as high as any firstborn, I follow Lark onto the platform. Within a few minutes, the Autoloop pulls into the station and we step aboard. When the pneumatic doors slide breathily shut, I flinch. I'm trapped. My speed and agility won't do a thing for me if there's trouble in here. But Lark sits on a molded lime green seat and slouches down so her knees press against the fuchsia seat in front of her. I slide in beside her, mimicking her position as the Autoloop lurches forward. It gains speed rapidly, accelerating on a monorail that coils in a spiral around Eden, from the center to the outer circles. Where? I try again, but she shushes me. Just look around. This is your first view of the rest of Eden. I'm curious to know what you think. She stands and wiggles until we've switched seats and I'm by the window. And I look. At scenery more vivid than a data block streaming past me, so fast that it almost blurs. Whenever I catch sight of something interesting, an oddly shaped building, a swirling green inside an algae spire, I have to whip my head around to follow it. Everything slips behind me. My body and my life are moving forward faster than I ever dared dream. The quality of the neighborhoods changes quickly. As I watch the gaudy lights of the inner circles dim to muted pastels, the chic evening clothes turn to darker, perfunctory casual garments. I realize we're on an express route to the outer circles. After what feels like a long time later, we slow our headlong rush and ascend to ground level. Figures become once again people, not blurs. When I was in my own entertainment circle, people traveled mostly in pairs, sometimes in loose, casual formations. It seemed as if everyone knew one another. Like, no matter their age, they were all basically part of the same crowd. People flowed from one group to another. Without exception, they were smiling, laughing, happy. Here, in this dingy outer circle, people either move through the streets in tight packs, or completely alone. The packs look uniform and tough. They don't wear the same clothes exactly, but each group seems to have a common theme. There is one pack in black, with tight, shining clothes and flashes of metal. I can't tell if they are studs or armor, or even weapons. Another group seems to be made up of people like the fascinating snake man I saw in the Rainforest Club. Like some peaceable, and at the same time savage, kingdom, they flock together. Birds with cats. Wolves with sheep. Moving among them are people utterly alone. Most are hunched and introverted, eyes on the ground, taking care to avoid contact with anyone else. But a few are different. Here and there, as the autoloop cruises into the final station, I see solitary men, and one woman, who look as if they'd be a match for even the black-clad group. They are upright, swaggering, arrogant in their bearing. They walk as if they owned the earth. The autoloop has almost stopped when I see him. A young man not much older than me, with bright chestnut hair and a face set in hard lines. He isn't as big as some of the other loners, but in a glance I can tell that he doesn't care, that he has absolute confidence that he can handle anything the world might throw at him. For a second his face turns, and I catch sight of a crescent-shaped scar from the corner of his left eye to just below his cheekbone. I pull my head back so he doesn't see me. But he was only glancing at the train. The next second we pulled into the covered station. Lark jumps to her feet, looking excited. "Come on," she says, pulling me after her and lunging for the door. Only a couple of other people rise along with us. Some of the inner circle travelers seem to be tourists. "That's the Dead Knight gang, I do believe," one woman says in cultured tones to her chic friend. "And you see that splendid specimen? That's the Jaguar. They say she once killed 5 men in one night." "I hear it was 4 men, a woman and a child," her companion says, shivering deliciously. They giggle softly behind their hands. The boisterously civilized inner rings were one thing, but Lark actually expects me to go into this maelstrom of danger and strange humanity? "Do you trust me?" Lark asks, when she sees the naked uncertainty on my face. I only pause for a second. In that instant, an image of Mom flashes through my mind. "Don't trust anyone except family," she would tell me. "Your very life is at stake." "I trust you completely," I say firmly. Lark smiles and takes me into the outer circles. What can I say about that night? To say it was like nothing I'd ever experienced would be pointless. I've never experienced anything. Like nothing I'd ever imagined? I didn't even know enough of the world, and people, and pleasure, to begin to imagine anything like it. "A girl who keeps her wits about her isn't in any danger," Lark tells me as we saunter through the dim streets. "They're not bad people. Just poor, that's all. Most would never dream of hurting anyone. As long as you don't make any mistakes. Apparently, there are a lot of potential mistakes I might make. One gang," she says, "would attack me if I spit within their sight. No worry about that. Even if I wasn't too polite, my mouth is far too dry. Another gang insists that anyone they pass should immediately stop and turn their backs on them. For them, keeping an eye on them is a sign of mistrust and a grave insult. If you turn your back, though, you're showing you trust them, and so they'll leave you alone. I would be lost without her. Again." She takes me to a club. A place both calm and wild at the same time. No one is dancing. There are booths and tables and recessed nooks hidden by curtains. People drink bitter black coffee, or as near as we can get, synthetic caffeine in a liquid suspension, and listen to someone on stage say perplexing, deep things that sound seditious. I don't quite understand him, but he speaks about freedom and autonomy, and endless open spaces in a way that makes my heart soar. We take a booth and listen to the conversations all around us. Everyone has an opinion. Voices rise. The mood turns agitated. Someone throws a chair across the room, shouting, "Better to be killed than lied to!" There is a quick brawl, before large bouncers tattooed all over in fern fronds haul out the offenders. And everyone else goes back to arguing about everything under the sun. It is wonderful. My skin is positively tingling with excitement. Or maybe caffeine. When Lark pays the tab and leads me out. "But I like it so much here," I protest. It was just right for me. An exciting spectacle I could enjoy without directly participating in. No one cared that I didn't make eye contact or engage in debate. They were too intent on their own points, too in love with the sound of their own voices to bother with me. It was like a classroom for me, a lesson in social behavior. But there's more, even better. Now that we're properly twitchy, we have to work it off. I don't know what she means, but I soon find out when we enter a warehouse tricked out like a jungle. It's almost entirely unlike the Rainforest Club. I can see the difference now. That was all about decor and style, about creating an impression. This place is as close to real as our dead planet can get. They seem to have ripped up a chunk of actual primordial forest from before the eco-fail, complete with deep, earthy, mossy smells, vines with wicked thorns, and shrieking beasts that swipe at my ankles. It seems thrillingly dangerous, utterly genuine. It is dark. A simulated moon hanging gibbous in the sky. But I can see people dashing across open spaces, diving for cover. "What is this place?" I ask. Lark looks at me with burning eyes. "Primal," she says, and hands me a stylized gun. For the next hour, we work as a team, shooting laser beams at our opponents as we leap like mad monkeys through the underbrush. It's a battle of man against man, but also man against nature. The jungle doesn't take sides. Simulated serpents strike our ankles, giving us electric shocks and deactivating our weapons for several minutes. Robotic jaguars knock us to the ground just as we're about to score a point. By the end, Lark is out of the game, and so is almost everyone else. It's just me against a team of three, evidently experienced players in matching uniforms. Without Lark holding me back, I scale a tall tree and annihilate them from 30 feet up in the air. I'm panting, sweating, exhausted, and utterly happy. "Ugh, Lark," I say when I slither down the artificial tree. "This is perfect. Just perfect. Thank you." She sways toward me for a second, then pulls away. "The night's not over yet," she says with her quirky smile. I can't even imagine what might be in store for me next. Dancing? Racing? Fighting? It is something completely different. And infinitely better. An abandoned algae spire. "It hasn't worked for years," Lark says. "My dad was fixing the pumping system, but they canceled the repairs before he could get it operational." I snatched his keycard. The door clicks unlocked, and she pulls it open on creaking hinges. Inside, it is pitch black. I hang back, but Lark pulls me into the darkness and shuts the door behind us. "The power has been cut," she says, "but I know the way." Her voice is like a beacon in the black. I fumble for her hand, but she's suddenly out of reach. "Where are you?" I call, and her voice answers from too far away. "Walk forward," she instructs. She sounds farther away now. I have no idea the size or shape of the room, what might be hiding in it. "Where are you?" I call again. I feel lost, disoriented. "Wait for me!" She laughs, low and rich. "You're safe. Just walk." "But I can't see." What if there's an obstacle, a chasm, a green shirt lurking in the dark? I feel paralyzed. "Do you trust me?" Lark asks again. I do trust her. I might not have much experience with people, but I know in my heart that Lark will never do me any harm. I take a deep breath and step into the obsidian darkness. My paces are shuffling, tentative, but eventually my outstretched hands meet Lark's fingers. They intertwine like vines. I can't see a thing, but I can almost feel her smiling. "Now up," she says, and guides my hands to the rungs of a ladder. We climb forever, hundreds of feet. The journey is surreal. We don't talk, but I can hear her breathing just above me, hear the sounds of her feet hitting each slippery metal rung. Without any visual to orient myself, I feel like I'm climbing in a dream. And Lark, above, is leading me deeper, higher, to some place I never imagined. Finally, an eternity of climbing later, I hear the scrape of a metal latch, and suddenly Lark is illuminated from above with a faint glow of light. She climbs out of the narrow ladder shaft, and when I clamber after her, I find myself looking down on all of Eden. The pale green concentric rings stretch out farther than I can see, away from the glittering eye of the center. I feel like the Eco-Panopticon itself, looking down on all that remains of mankind. "How did you even find this place?" I ask her. Then before she can answer, I add, "And what's an inner circle girl like you doing all the way out here in the boonies anyway?" We're far from our home circle. Though the height and the darkness lend a glamour to the streets directly below us, I can still see the squalor, the rundown buildings, the furtive scurrying of the pedestrians. "I used to live here," I gasp. I knew that Lark had relocated from another circle when she was about 10 years old. When she came to the Kalahari school, Ash was selected to show her around. He told me about her that night, and every night since. But I'd assumed she'd moved from the next ring out. That apparently wasn't too uncommon. Moving so far inward from one of the outer circles was unheard of. I remember that her arrival in our elite school caused a bit of a stir. Ash told me that some of her classmates wouldn't invite her to birthday parties, and that her parents were shunned. Even my dad wondered aloud at dinner one evening whether Ash shouldn't curtail his friendship with a girl of low origin, as he put it. This wasn't the outermost circle, but it was close. Maybe 2 rings in from the slums of the farthest outer circle. I couldn't imagine Lark living here. She told me her story briefly while I tried to hide any trace of surprise or, earth forbid, disgust from my face. She came from a diligent, hard-working family who lived in a multi-story tenement in this district. They scraped by for a living and were happy. Sure, there were problems. Sometimes there were blackouts, where the water turned the color of rust. Sometimes green shirts hauled a neighbor away. Once she even found a dead body on the front stoop. But it wasn't bad. You knew who your friends were, and everyone here could keep a secret. She told me how her father had discovered something while working on the water conduits deep under the spire. He was a construction worker, basically, laying pipes and repairing valves. Then one day, he found something. What, I naturally want to know. She shrugs. He wouldn't say. Not even to his boss. But he managed to find a center official, and told him what he found. And almost immediately afterward, he got a center job in the city planning division, and we moved to the inner circle. And you have no idea what he discovered? No. He just told us enough that we'd understand why our fortune suddenly changed. But he made it clear that his life depended on secrecy. And then, her brow crinkles, I mentioned it a couple of years later, and it was like he didn't remember it at all. He said he'd gotten promoted because he invented a new kind of automatic shutoff valve, and the people at the center were so impressed they elevated his status. Maybe he was just really committed to the lie, I suggest. Maybe he was protecting you. Maybe, she says, then shakes her head so her lilac hair brushes her cheeks. But let's not talk about that. I brought you here for the view. Look up. I've been so focused on looking down at the city I've yearned for all my life that I haven't looked skyward. I follow her gaze up to the heavens and gasp. tip of the algae tower spirals into a sharp point above us. But beyond that, the universe. My fingertips reach into my pocket to touch the ancient photo I've brought.